Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the January 20, 2022 presentation by the Santa Clarita Valley Chapter of the Aerospace and Defense Forum. This morning's topic is an economic outlook for 2022 and possible impacts on the aerospace and defense industry. I'm Eric Jensen, chairperson of the Aerospace and Defense Forum Santa Clarita Valley Chapter and president of Jensen Next Level Consulting. The Aerospace and Defense Forum is designed to provide a way for those in and supporting the aerospace and defense industry to communicate information, ideas, collaborate on projects, and develop business with each other. It is a networking forum. There's 9 chapters, and in the absence of a global pandemic, we usually meet monthly. The most recent chapter to be part of the AMD forum is the Ventura chapter. In addition, there is a monthly newsletter, over 230 recordings of chapter presentations and tours of A&D sites when we are meeting in person. To continue fulfilling our purpose, we plan no less than 3 webinars a month until in-person meetings can be resumed. And that is a TBD at this point. More information can be found at the website at the Aerospace and Defense Forum.
All right.
Logistics. Cool. Ivan, if we could have the next slide, please. And I've covered that. We're 11-year-old business. Next slide, please, Ivan. Guidelines. You should be on mute while you're in the webinar. There's a mic icon in the lower left, which can be crossed out, should be crossed out. Please click and make sure you're on mute. Your video camera also should be off and clicked on to show crossed out. We're going to handle questions through the chat. So if you have questions during presentation, please put them into the chat. I'll gather those questions and I'll pose them to presenters at the end of the session. There's going to be a recording of this webinar posted on the A&D forum. I'll make sure you know that all attendees will receive an email when the recording is available. All attendees will receive the contact information for those attendees that grant a position. Permission. Next slide, Ivan. I want to recognize our sponsor for the Santa Clarita Valley Aerospace and Defense Forum, the Santa Clarita Valley Economic Development Corporation. They have been our host and sponsor from the start. They've been extremely supportive and helpful. And I thank them very much for what they've been doing. They are instrumental also in the success of the Santa Clarita Valley and bringing businesses in, and they're very active in the community. Okay, at this point, I have the next slide. I am pleased to introduce Paul Single and Katie McDowell. Let me give you some background on these two exceptional presenters. Mr. Single joined City National Rochdale in 2003 and has more than 38 years of experience managing investment portfolios. He's responsible for research, analysis, and implementation of various core taxable fixed income strategies. He's a member of the firm's Investment Strategy Committee. This is the group that determines the most appropriate balance of investments for clients' portfolios. Additionally, he's a member of City National Bank's Asset Liability Committee, which is the risk management group that evaluates, monitors, and improves practices relating to the bank's balance sheet and capital structure. Paul is a frequent lecturer on the economy and investments and a contributing author to the monthly and quarterly economic reports. Prior to joining City National, Mr. Single managed fixed income portfolios at Wells Fargo Bank, Wells Capital Management, and at the Benham Management Group, which is now part of the American Century family of funds. He enjoys time outside with his wife, 2 young boys, cycling, sailing, and especially hiking in Yosemite National Park. Ms. McDowell joined City National Bank in 2019 and has more than 15 years experience in the finance and investment banking industry. She's focused on the aerospace and defense and engineering and construction industries. Deep corporate finance background, including experience leading and negotiating transactions in debt markets, letters of credit, real estate, leasing, treasury management, and hedging, foreign exchange, interest rate, and commodity derivatives. Prior to joining City National, Ms. McDowell was Senior Vice President of Wells Fargo and GE Capital, Vice President at Chains Capital Partners. Prior to her business career, she was on the Olympic sailing team, taking a fifth place in the women's sailing 470 class in Athens. Ms. McDowell has a BA in American Studies from Brown University and an MBA in Finance and Investment Management from the Yale School of Management. At this point, I'm going to turn it over to Paul, and then Paul will turn it over to Katie. If we can go to the next slide, please, Ivan, and I will go on mute.
Eric, thank you so much. It's a real honor for me to be able to present today. We've got a very optimistic view about what's going on in the economy. If you can just move to the next page, please. I want to start off with how people are feeling about the economy. And this is an interesting conundrum that we have going on right now. This is a chart showing the consumer sentiment or confidence that Americans have in their economy and their outlook. And when you see economic charts like this, gray columns represent recessionary periods. But you can see from this light blue line here that the level of confidence in the economy is, well, naturally, it's lower than what it was before the pandemic started. But what's interesting is that it's lower now than it was during the lockdown. And this I find very perplexing. For example, the economy is so much stronger now than it was back then. The economy is 13% stronger. The labor force, back then the unemployment rate was 14.7%. Now it's down to 3.9%. 19 million people have been hired since that lockdown. The S&P 500, to give an example of how household wealth has appreciated. Back then it was at 2,900. Right now it's around 4,800. That's an increase of 65%. And home values, they're up 25% since that. You can see where I'm going with this is that, by and large, the economy is doing extremely well, but the American consumer is not feeling that way. And it is for a whole host of reasons. The next chart here is probably the primary reason for it, and it has to do with the fact that COVID is still a concern and frustration for many people. The dark blue line is the number of cases that we have going on. As you can see, we surpassed the peak of last year. The gray line is the amount of deaths. Fortunately, we're not up to that level again. The latest variant doesn't seem to be as severe as past ones, and so hopefully we will get past this in a few months. But Americans are just frustrated having to deal with this over and over again. And it's constantly in the news, and it's become a big political issue for many people, so that makes it even more difficult for some. Next page. But this is probably the biggest reason in terms of the frustration that people have, and that's the price of gasoline. In California, gasoline is far more expensive than it is nationwide. Here's a recent picture of a gas station near my house. The chart on the right just shows the national level, which is much lower. California's much higher gasoline prices because of our taxes, and there's not as much competition. But the gray column that you see here represents the percent change year over year, and it's up 45%. It's a big deal, and it frustrates people. So that's a big concern. Next page. But in terms of the growth of the economy, it's off to a strong start, mainly due to the generosity of the federal government and the work by the Federal Reserve Bank. The Federal Reserve Bank cut interest rates to near zero. They did big bond buying programs to push down intermediate and longer-term rates, which allowed refinancing, which provided more cash flow for many households. But the federal government, they added a ton of stimulus, about $5.5 trillion. To put in perspective of what we've seen compared to past economic slowdowns, it represents about 43% of GDP. These are all the programs that are passed, plus the Build Back Better one. So that one's not, we probably won't be seeing that one pass. But it gives you an idea. The number's quite big. Compare that to a little over a decade ago with Obama's attempt at trying to add stimulus. He tried an awful lot more, but Congress was not willing. So it was only about 6% of GDP. But what we're seeing is comparable to what happened following the Great Depression. It's an awful lot of money that's going to many households, small businesses, and large businesses to help generate greater growth in the economy. And we're seeing it. This is the percent change in GDP since the recession ended, and we're comparing it to the last two. The light blue line that you see here, that's showing the dot-com bubble, the recession that followed that. The gray is what happened following the global financial crisis. Again, back then, at this stage, the economy was about 3% stronger. We're about 13% stronger. we're head and toes above anything else we've seen before. And this strong economic growth is causing some problems at the frustrating Americans. Next page. In terms of the payrolls, you can see this chart here on the left. It shows the total amount of people that are hired. It was on a nice linear path going into the recession. In 2 months, it plummeted. We're working our way back, but you can see that the growth is much better than what we've seen in the past in the chart on the right. We're just 2.3% below what we were before the pandemic started. Compare that to the last two recessions. At this stage of the last two recessions, we were still losing jobs. So you can see the trajectory of this economy much better than what we have seen in the past. In terms of the market, though, it's much different. There are far more people, far more job openings out there than there are people looking for jobs, and that's frustrating many, many people. The chart on the left here, the blue line shows the number of job openings. The gray line is the number of people looking for jobs. The right-hand side, we're doing the math for you. There's 1.4 jobs out there for every job, every person looking for a job. It's a market, in which case the worker has far more power in terms of negotiating salaries than they've ever had before. Next page. And the big reason for this has to do with the fact that we just don't see as many people in the labor force as we had in the past. The chart on the left is the labor force participation rate. This is the amount of people that are working or looking for a job as a percent of that whole age group. And you can see during the 60s, 70s, and 80s, that moved up significantly, mainly because women were coming into the workforce. And that's really what drove economic growth in the United States well above the rest of the world. But it's been moving down since then as the population has been aging. But right now, we're below where we were before the pandemic started. And there are two reasons for this. The major cohort for it is the part on the right. It's men that are over 55 years of age. They've retired early. They've accumulated a great deal of wealth, whether it's stocks or their homes. And they have health concerns. They're retiring, and they're probably not going to come back. Another cohort is young women who have children. Child care is very, very difficult to get right now because of the pandemic. And as a result, they're forced to stay home. But not as many people in the labor force. It means that the unemployment rate is probably about as low as it's going to get. Next page. But the spending, this is the biggest issue in terms of the economy. When you take a look at GDP, the broadest measure of the economy, two-thirds of it is spending. So how that goes determines economic growth. And you can see we're up 25% compared to other expansions. And the reason, again, is the fact that the government was very generous in terms of sending checks out to many small businesses and individuals. And because of the lockdown, there's increased savings. And as a result, households have an awful lot more money. Next page. How are they spending their money? The light blue line here shows that they're spending it on goods. They're not spending it on services, which is the dark blue line, not nearly as much. And there's a good reason for that. You just can't do that. Think about the last few years. I mean, you want to go on vacation, an airline ticket, a hotel, amusement park tickets. Those are all services, and we haven't seen as much of that spending. It's all been funneled into goods, and this is the problem with inflation. All this money being funneled into a small sector where supply is limited because of production cutbacks or because of transportation and port problems is causing prices to move up so much. Next page. And households are flush with cash. The chart on the left, the dark blue line, shows that we have $2.8 trillion more in savings accounts than we did before the pandemic. We have another $1.3 trillion in money market funds, a lot of liquid cash out there. And this will continue to be the driving force of the economy going forward. As the economy moves up and down and has its ebbs and flows, there is still the wealth that's there. And household debt service, you can see that's moved down. The leveraging that the baby boomers did has all been fully reversed by the younger generation. They do not want the leverage that their parents had. Next page. And housing. Housing is, we've seen home prices move up more than 20% year over year. The main reason for that is the fact that there's just not enough housing out there for the strong demand. When homes are sold, the 9 out of 10 homes are an existing home. Baby boomers are not moving out of their homes like their parents did or the parents before them. So there's not that extra supply. Plus, we're having a lot more buyers coming to the markets than we ever had before. Large corporations are buying up homes or have been pretty much since the global financial crisis to rent them out. So there's just not the supply, and prices have changed quite a bit. Next page. And this is all leading into inflation. Inflationary pressures are higher. The chart on the left is CPI. You can see it's at the highest level we've had in 40 years. Why? The chart on the right does a clear example. We break it down between goods and services. It's mostly goods that we're seeing the big price increases because of the shortages that are out there and the extremely strong demand that the consumers have for that. Services, they're a little higher, but not a whole lot. Next page. If you break down the components of CPI into the eight major categories, they're color-coded here on the left, you can see that. It's one sector that's really causing it all. Vertical is the percent change year over year of each one of those sectors. The horizontal is the weighting. So the dark blue that you see, housing is where most of the money is spent. That's up, but not nearly as high as what we've seen in other areas. But it's the light blue, transportation. What's this? Gasoline, motor oil. New cars, which are up around 12% year over year, used cars, which are up 53% year over year, because there's just not the supply of new cars. And on the right-hand side, you can see the recent trend in these. This is a three-month moving average of each one of those categories, and transportation continues to be the main reason why we're seeing higher levels of inflation. The green, that's apparel. That's a very volatile group. It's because of the lack of supply. That's why those prices are up higher. Next page. Here's the home prices chart, I guess, get out of order. But you can see year over year, much higher than we had during the bubble. More importantly, they're higher in most metropolitan areas. It's about 80% of the metropolitan areas have prices that are at least 10% higher than they were beforehand. The breakdown on the right-hand side is the year over year change. You can see southern warm cities that had cheaper real estate have had the biggest price increases. Northern, colder ones that are very expensive tend to have the lower price appreciation. And energy, this is the big deal. Oil prices are above $80 a barrel. Seems very high compared to a year ago when it was just $45 a barrel. But you can see that the price that we have is pretty much what we averaged during the past expansion. So it's not new territory, but the year-over-year change does look severe. Next page, please. There we go. The reason for why is mainly because of supply. OPEC is not producing nearly as much as it did before. It's down 8%. There's a lot of geopolitical issues that are going on there, but they are enjoying the higher prices because of the lack of supply they're bringing. Interestingly, in the United States, production is down quite a bit. The main reason for this is a lot of the big oil companies, the big energy companies, have been using their money and spending it in terms of trying to find greener ways of producing energy. And as a result, they have not been doing as much fracking, and we're not seeing nearly as much supply. Next page. And the inventories are very, very low. The dark blue line is the level of inventory that we have. The light blue line is the five-year moving average. The gray is the range. You can see inventory levels are very, very low for oil. This is a problem if we have a cold winter. Chart on the right just shows gasoline inventory prices. They had been around average. They boosted up a little bit, mainly as a result of the president releasing a lot of the strategic reserve and that being refined into gasoline. But this is the chart, and this is the most important chart of the whole presentation, is one of the one I'll conclude with. This is household net worth. This is the amount of people's cash, investments, value of their house, minus all their liabilities. You can see the dark blue line. It's up almost 28% since the recession started. Compare that to the average of the last five, which is the light blue line. You can see normally at this stage, household wealth is hardly appreciated at all. The gray is the range of the last five expansions, and we're well above anything that we've ever seen. The high end of that range was in the early 1970s. You can see households are in great financial shape. So they can weather the ebbs and flows of the economy as it continues to move forward, but it will be the driving force of economic growth for a number of years. So let me turn it over to Patty to give you some more insight in terms of the aerospace and defense area. Patty.
Good morning. Thrilled to be here, Eric, Ivan. Thank you for inviting us. I think it's nice to see familiar faces. It's nice to kick off the year. So happy new year, everyone. Ivan, if we could switch to the next page. Just going to give you a little overview on City National Bank and our aerospace and defense practice before jumping into some of the themes that I'm seeing in the market. kind of what we're seeing over the last 2 years. So City National Bank, we're a U.S. regional bank founded in 1954. I'm sure you've all seen some of our branches or logos. We have a pretty strong presence in Southern California. We've really grown to expand to have more of a national footprint. In 2015, we were acquired by Royal Bank of Canada, which is an exceptionally strong financial institution. So we have a nice partnership with them. Strong credit profile. Really what we're trying to do is be a relationship bank, high touch. We have a fairly thin branch model, but we're looking to provide, corporate banking, specialty banking, commercial banking, private banking, really trying to provide the whole range of commercial banking solutions to the middle market. Next slide, Ivan. So our team, our aerospace and defense team, we launched in 2018. We are now at 10 dedicated heads, both on the credit and relationship side. It's been a pretty steep growth for us. I think the pandemic has been a pretty busy time for us. So since 2018, we've committed more than $1.1 billion in credit and managed over $300 million for our clients. We have a dedicated relationship team, dedicated credit team, so our processes tend to be very efficient in terms of, being able to work with the clients as their needs arise. We have a strong bench of product partners that we work with. So these are just, unfortunately, I couldn't include some of the logos, but many logos you would all recognize, but we're really trying to work with companies in the middle market and kind of upper mid corporate space. So think companies that are founder owned, 50 million in revenues up to 5 billion. Anything above 5 billion, we partner with RBC on. So that is our practice, a little advertisement for us. Next slide, Ivan. And these are just some of the solutions and products that we offer. So lending and leasing, term loans, revolvers, acquisition, bridge finance, ABL, on the treasury side, liquidity strategies, deposit, escrow, corporate card. We have capital markets. We have capital markets within City National Bank, and then for kind of ECM and ECM products, we work with RBC, and then we have our risk management and international banking products as well. So rates and trade and supply chain finance, which I think is actually pretty relevant to our industry. So next slide. So today, just looking to cover, where is air traffic? How are the airlines doing? What does the commercial OEM production rate look like? What are the impacts of the supply chain? And, I think that we've seen a lot of gray over the last couple of years. And I do think, and I think this echoes kind of what Paul was saying in terms of, being bullish around the overall economy. But I think there are some reasons for us to be, as an industry, to be optimistic. So next slide, please. So I think we've probably all seen, some charts of traffic and bookings falling off the cliff March of last year. We've seen some growth, some recovery. We've seen variants impact the stability of that growth. I think now we saw Delta over the summer. We see that reflected in the chart. We're now in Omicron, and hopefully we're at the tail end of, we're getting to be at the tail end of Omicron. But really what's been driving the growth in bookings and overall traffic has been domestic market. So if you look at the U.S. domestic market, we have a really strong network, China, Russia, intra-Europe. So that's really driving a lot of the recovery. I think, the wide body market was oversaturated before the pandemic. So that kind of created an issue. And then with the pandemic hitting, it basically worsened that situation. So, good news is domestic markets are good. There's a lot of pent up demand. International / wide body, I think that's going to struggle for a while. I think if you look at developed countries, I think vaccination rates are pretty high. In developing countries, there's a bit of a different story there. So I think some of those factors are going to impact kind of the recovery of the international market and the wide body. But I think, the expectation is that is that we're going to see, you know, 2022-2023, you know, pretty good domestic recovery, and then, you know, 2023-2024, you'll probably start seeing normalized levels of international travel. Next slide, please. So airlines that, you know, I think a lot of us on the call here are working with companies that are making parts for aircraft or defense. And so, you know, at the end of the day, it's the airlines and their health that's driving kind of production. So, you know, I think you're seeing recovery. I think there are a couple drags on the recovery. I think notably, as Paul had pointed out, fuel prices are high right now. And so I think that's dragging on overall profitability. You know, if you look at kind of the valuation of airline stocks, IATA has airline stocks still being about 30% lower than 2019 levels. So I think there's good news here in that there is recovery. You're starting to see, you know, the balance sheets still aren't where they were. But I think it's good to see, you know, some optimism in terms of overall airline health. And so hopefully that trend will continue, and hopefully, you know, we'll have a better handle on the impact and kind of, you know, the impact of new variants, and, you know, hopefully we'll move from the pandemic to an endemic stage soon. Next slide, Ivan. So this is probably something that everyone's been in touch with. So during the pandemic, I mean, you know, we have a very complex supply chain. And so while the demand may not have been there for new aircraft, Boeing and Airbus did maintain some levels of production to ensure that the supply chain would stay healthy and be in a position to recover as kind of the demand increased. You know, Boeing increased its deliveries from 118 aircraft, and I think they ended up the year with a delivery of 340. And then Airbus, they ended up delivering 611. So not as big of an impact, but a lot of that has to do with the 87 and the MAX. But, you know, I think we're seeing a light at the end of the tunnel there, but as I've mentioned, you know, narrow bodies are driving the recovery. Airbus is looking to get to 64 320s a month by Q2 of 23, potentially going up to 75. Boeing right now, I think they're at 19 at the end of the year, and they're looking to get to 31 a month. I mean, at the end of the day, while production levels were down, there's still just a tremendous backlog for these aircrafts. Boeing has 2,400 and I'm sorry, Airbus has 2,400 and Boeing has 3,300 plus for their narrow bodies. So next slide, please. So I think that there are still pretty significant risks to the supply chain. And, you know, you can look at the OEs, you can look at the large tier ones and tier twos, the public companies that have access to public markets. You know, I think those companies will be okay. I personally worry about the smaller, middle market companies that are really the engine of the supply chain. You know, as Paul mentioned, I mean, there was just a tremendous injection of liquidity into the market by the government. It was through CARES. It was through, accelerated payments through the primes. And so I think that really helped buoy the supply chain and have, you know, inject liquidity so that, you know, they were still able to survive. I think, you know, the dynamic, that we saw was, you know, prior to the pandemic, prior to the MAX, a lot of the kind of tier three, tier four suppliers were investing pretty heavily in people, equipment, R&D, and they were leveraging their balance sheet for that. And so, you know, I'm a senior lender, and so I look at leverage often when we're talking to companies and looking at debt packages. And so, you know, I think a combination of investment and leveraging the balance sheet coupled with reduction in earnings over the last 2 years has created a challenge, I think, for some of the suppliers in terms of their access to capital and liquidity. So I think you're seeing higher leverage points You know, when we first started the pandemic, we were talking to many companies, and you know, we were looking at potentially putting in new facilities, credit facilities. And you know, at that point in time, it was stay with your existing relationship, and we can talk kind of when we get through this. I mean, I think it's important for companies to maintain those active dialogues, but given that I think the government has probably turned off the spigot, you know, it's will smaller companies have the balance sheet, the relationship to have access to the liquidity that they'll need for the ramp that we're ultimately going to get to? I mean, that's going to be increases in staffing, funding inventory, other working capital requirements. So there's going to be a need for liquidity, and I think you know, I think that's a concern from my perspective. I think one of the biggest issues that our industry faces is the workforce. And I think, you know, as you know, unemployment rates are very low. I mean, as Paul mentioned, a lot of people have retired early. I would say that our industry tends to skew towards the older age range. And so I think you had early retirements. I think you have the younger population that is on the sidelines as well. But, you know, if you look at kind of where we are today versus pre-pandemic, we're still 4% below in terms of heads and jobs. So a lot of that has hit kind of the smaller suppliers. And so I think that's concerning. I think another challenge that we as an industry are facing is, you know, how are we going to capture the tribal knowledge that our kind of older workforce has, and how are we going to bring in the younger talent to backfill that pipeline? And so I think there's going to be continued challenges. I mean, I think that there are going to be improved efficiencies through, you know, smart factory digitization. But I do think that this is a big concern for me. You know, I think that other industries are maybe appealing more to younger talent, just in the sense that, you know, if you think of technology companies and other type industries that might be perceived as sexier than aerospace and defense. I would disagree with that, but, you know, I think that we as an industry need to be very conscientious of that, making sure that we're attracting, you know, a younger generation, making sure that, you know, providing the flexibility, the upward mobility, making sure that there's alignment in kind of a value proposition. I think that, you know, this younger kind of Gen Z, millennial generation, I think alignment of mission, alignment of values has become an increasingly important element of how they look at companies to work for and with. And I think, you know, it's interesting. I mean, DEI, I think, has become a buzzword. I think it's been, or a buzz acronym, it's been an important element for companies to think through and have a roadmap for. So it's no longer kind of a conceptual idea. It's not a nice to have anymore. It's a need to have. And I think that, you know, again, to the younger generations, I think it's really important for them to see our industry really evolve in that respect. I think we're still, you know, I think 25% of women in the workforce, the minority, talent is much lower than other industry averages. So something that I think the industry on the whole needs to be focused on. And then, you know, it's a lot of what a lot of other industries are seeing, but increased costs, wages, inflation. This is going to put more pressure on suppliers. Elite Partners actually said that the aviation industry paid 27 to 44% more for raw materials, and I would expect 21 versus 22, and I would expect that to continue. You know, increased costs for new equipment, which is going to be required to support the ramp up, longer lead times. You know, these are supply chain issues that are going to persist for a little while longer. But and then you also think about industry and governmental regulations. I mean, it's you think about AS9100 and kind of the costs of implementing that for a smaller business when they're already stretched from a liquidity perspective. So I think that there are some risks and challenges to the supply chain, but I do think, and next slide, Ivan. I do think that there are reasons for optimism. In 21, the industry grew at 7.5%. We're expecting a 20-plus increase in 2022. I mean, yes, that's off the press numbers, but I think that that's, you know, I think the expectation is for a robust recovery. Deliveries increased 40% in 21, and it's expected that they're going to increase another 40% in 22. Record narrow-body backlogs and, you know, increasing year-over-year build rates. I mean, Airbus going to 64, possibly going into the 70s. I mean, those are high production rates, and those will come, you know. And then I think just, you know, the fundamental macro demands for aircraft is there. I think it's meaningful. You know, I think you have regions that have populations that are moving into the middle class that will have disposable income. They're going to need to be replacement aircraft. And so Boeing and Airbus are a little bit different, 43,000 new aircraft over the next 3 years. And Airbus is expecting about 39,000. But those are big numbers. So, I think that that's very positive. I think right now, you know, yes, we've been in a pandemic for 2 years, but, you know, I think we will work our way through this and, you know, hopefully 22 will be a stronger year. I think the other, you know, another area to be optimistic about is the defense budget, $768 billion. I think there was some concern around how the Biden administration was going to view the budget. I think most folks thought that it was either going to be flat or potentially depressed. So I think that there's, positive momentum in the sense that, you know, there's less concern about the reduction and more stability just in terms of the Biden administration's view. And then I think you're seeing, you know, more focused funding to specific areas that I think are going to create opportunities for our different suppliers. I mean, hypersonics, they've increased funding by 20%. DoD is authorized to increase funding for R&D and cyber and emerging tech. There's increased funding for space-related activity, so the Space Force. So I think those are all really positive trends. And, yeah, we're also seeing continued demand for domestic military products. As one of my colleagues used to say, the world isn't getting to be a safer place, unfortunately. But if you look at, the fifth gen JSF, the B-21, there's demand for these products. The global military spend, I think 2022, and that's the latest data I had, it was at $2 trillion, so global military spend. That's an increase of 2.6 over 2019. And that's at a time where global GDP was down about 4.5%. So, there continues to be demand for military product. There continues to be, threats and uncertainty, geopolitical challenges, if it's Ukraine, Taiwan, Iraq. So there are challenges, but I think that's driving demand for military product. And, the government, the government, our U.S. government recognizes the importance of the industrial base and making sure that base is strong. And so, injecting additional capital into that industrial base, I think, is also a positive trend. Then on the, as Paula had mentioned, personal balance sheets are exceptionally strong today. Stock markets are high. Corporate profits are high. And so you're actually seeing higher business utilization than you did pre-pandemic. So while it's a pretty small part of the market, I think it's a good indicator. And I just think it's a nice bright spot in the overall kind of aerospace sector. And then emerging technologies, I think, Deloitte had this market growing $215 billion by 2035. Yes, that's a long ways away, but, there's a lot of activity and investment, private, public investment into AAM. Joby just received an airworthiness certificate for its second pre-production prototype back in, well, I guess it was a week or so, 2 weeks ago. the sustainable aviation fuels. I mean, that's sustainable aviation fuels. There's a lot of momentum there. It doesn't happen overnight. So I think in the next, 5 years, you'll see incremental change. But I think there's a lot of focus on how do we make our industry, how do we make airlines more fuel efficient, more environmental friendly, and then small unmanned aerial systems and space commerce. So I think the emerging technologies are coming more to the forefront. I think you're starting to see a lot more investment in emerging technologies, and so we'll see where those goes. So, but I do think that that's a bright spot. And then, I mean, just our industry on the whole has just been very resilient. We've gone through 2001, 9/11. The global financial crisis. This industry innovates, and I think it will innovate again through this crisis. I think the industry will be smarter. I think it'll be more efficient. I think again, you're going to see more and continued adoption of digitization, automation, robotics, smart factories, and so I think you're going to see a lot of efficiencies that have come out of these last 2 years and however long that the pandemic continues, but. I do think that while there has been, some challenging times over the last 2 years, I think as an industry, we've weathered it well. So that is what I will end on.
I'm going to take over here for Q&A. Thank you so much, Paul and Katie. If we can have Katie and Paul both on unmute so they can answer questions. Thank you, Ivan. There's a couple questions that have come across in the chat, and then I've got some questions myself. Let's see here. First question, in reference to airline financial performance in 2021 and more recently, what do the new ratios of business travel versus leisure travel look like as flight volumes recover? There's certainly been discussions about, there may be business travel never returns and maybe planes get reconfigured. Any thoughts on that, Katie?
I haven't actually looked at any data for the split. I think you are seeing some recovery in business travel. I do think largely it's been driven by pent-up demand for leisure travel. I've talked to CFOs and, they've said, instead of doing a roadshow that takes 3 weeks, I can do a roadshow in 3 days. So there are a lot of efficiencies that have been created. I've talked to other CFOs and they say, there's probably not going to be a time where I get on an airplane and fly 4 hours for, a 2 hour meeting. So I think that there have been technology tools. I mean, we're on one right now that's going to change how business travel is done. I don't think anyone knows what that really is going to look like. But I do think that you are going to have fundamental changes around business travel. I do think it will come back. I do think, as we all know, networking over a screen is much more challenging than in person. So I think, businesses will prioritize their travel spend and I think be more efficient around it.
All right. There's quite a few here, so we'll see if we can get through them. Any comments on space-related production, products, services for 2022, 2023, private commercial growth, et cetera? Katie?
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting. We had looked at, again, as a senior lender, we're looking for kind of more mature companies that we can work with. And so, we had started to see kind of a bubbling of space activity. And I think the public-private investment into the industry has been stronger than I think we expected. I think the market's matured more than we expected. So I think it's a really positive development. I think one thing that that I think you will see, and I didn't touch on M&A at all in my presentation, but you're seeing companies that are technology companies, you know, and I think a lot of it is around space and satellite and launch. I think you're seeing those companies being, I would expect to see those companies acquired. So I think that you're going to see some activity in the space market around M&A. But I also think that you're going to see continued growth in that market. I think it's, you know, it's become a priority for the DoD. I think, you know, what we're able to do from a nanosat perspective, from a launch perspective with reusable launch vehicles. I mean, it's becoming a more efficient market, and I think it's become a more, you know, a more effective process just in the sense of being able to put satellites up that into LEO that, are giving us, you know, current day technology versus kind of the old buses that would go up. And so I think, you know, there's continued demand for data, for information on the commercial side. So I think it's going to continue to grow. I think, you know, that the development of the Space Force, I think, is also another positive development. So I would expect continued growth. I would expect some consolidation, and I would also expect some acquisitions from some of the larger players looking to acquire certain technologies.
Okay. Paul, a question, let's see if I can pull this together. I've got a lot of notes here. When you, when we have events such as COVID, it drives paradigm shifts, you know, in the industry and across the world. So we now have, if I could, these, some questions woven here. So the savings rate is up higher than it's been in quite a while, and people have more net worth than they've had. Do you think that, of course, that ties into how they spend their money and so on and so forth. Do you think that will remain, or do you think that people will get back to where they were before? Or do you think there's a paradigm shift that's gone on that people have been affected and said, okay, I'm not going to run my bank account down that far, et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah, that's a very important question because it's really going to determine economic growth. I mean, the chart showed how much money people have. It's a lot of money. The general feeling is that they will retain most of it. The younger generation is much different than the baby boomers. Baby boomers were really happy to lever up their balance sheet. But many of the millennials saw what happened to many of their parents during the housing crisis of a decade ago, in which they lost an awful lot of their wealth. Because for many households, that's the big part of their wealth. So they're not eager to lever up their balance sheet like their parents are. They're much more like the parents of the baby boomers, those that lived through the Great Depression, those that lived through World War II. So they're far more frugal with their money. So the expectation is that spending will be a little bit stronger than what we had seen because there is just so much wealth. But leverage of balance sheets at households will stay quite low.
Okay. I think that's good news. It allows you to absorb some shocks in the future.
Exactly.
Also, when you look at the consumer price index and cost of gasoline, and by the way, last month I got the highest gas bill I've ever gotten, ever received. So, but do you see, when do you see where and wages have increased, but not as fast as inflation? Do you see that gap closing in the future where inflation starts to come back down and wages catch up, so people's overall income versus costs or disposable income is back to where it was?
Yeah. I mean, you talk about a paradigm shift. You know, prior to the pandemic, if you thought about how most people in this country shopped, they bought mostly from Walmart and Amazon. Those are the biggest retailers in the country. They became the biggest retailers by being the low-cost provider. But over the last year and year and a half or so, the buyers at those stores have not been trying to chase down the lowest price. They're just trying to find content, put things on their shelves. So once we get back to the point where the supply chain is back to normal, then I think it's pretty safe to assume that people will become low-cost providers. I mean, those that are low-cost providers will succeed because people will be very conscious of how they spend their money. They're no longer getting checks from the government anymore. I mean, it's very easy to go out and spend an extra dollar or two for a beer with a friend when you're reopening an economy and you have a lot of cash sitting in your pocket. But what happens when your wage growth isn't strong enough to support inflation? Well, you don't spend as much and the economy slows down and prices come down.
Okay. We have quite a few here. I'm going to keep going. So This says the industry grew, I assume this is for Katie, at 7.5% in 2021. Is that aircraft production value or aircraft units made?
Good question. It's production value.
Okay, super. So, and I'm going to combine this with a question I have. So part of the question is, are the prospects for airline consolidation? And also, there's been a lot of, surprising to me, number of new low-cost carriers that have come out. So what do you see along those lines, Katie?
I would be surprised to see additional consolidation. I think there's already been a lot of consolidation as it is. I mean, you know, you have American, US Air, you have Northwest and Delta. I mean, you know, those were a while ago, but I mean, there was a period where there was great consolidation. And so I think I would be more inclined to see airlines go BK rather than be acquired. And so I think the business model has changed for some of the smaller carriers. So I think it's unlikely to see more airline consolidation.
Okay. And Katie, the 40% delivery increase forecasted for 2022, that was versus 21. Okay. And that's based on
production rates.
Production rates. Okay. So, and this is my other question, my next question. So when I look at the production rates, and if Airbus says, oh, we're going to produce 75 a month, and I look at the supply chain, which is this members of the supply chain are no longer there. They went bankrupt, et cetera. There's challenges with material costs. There's challenges with material availability. And I think the most significant challenge is worker availability, expertise availability, which you've already mentioned. Any thoughts on whether they can actually get to those rates, considering the constraints that they're facing?
It's a really good question. I think, I think, yes, are they going to be able to get them at the speed they are looking to get them, or from the timetable they're looking to make those increases? And that, I don't know. I suspect those big rate increases will likely shift to the right. I think there is demand for it. I think one of the challenges facing both Boeing and Airbus to a lesser degree, just because I think they have really tried to bolster their European supply chain, and I think they do still have strong relationship with their supply chain in the U.S. But smaller suppliers, they were able to, some, not all, were able to take some of their capacity and shift it more to military. So instead of being, a 70-30% output weighted towards commercial, they've now taken some of that capacity from defense. And so, I think there is capacity still there. But I think it just depends on whether or not Boeing and Airbus, to a certain extent, is going to be able to bring some of that capacity back to commercial. So I think there needs to be assurances from the supply chain that they will have that that dedicated demand. And so I do think that they will be able to get there. I think there was significant investment prior to the MAX grounding, prior to the pandemic, to support those rates, but the question is just, what's the timeline going to look like?
Okay. And I'm going to try to squeeze in two more here, Ivan, before we wrap up. So a question, do you have concerns about potential overvaluation of stock market or companies themselves and that impacting financial growth, the GDP, et cetera? Paul or Katie?
I can start with that. In terms of NASDAQ, we've already seen a 10% retracement from the peak. So that's correction. And we're expecting to see that in both the S&P 500 and the Dow. I mean, it's been on an extremely strong bullish run for a long period of time. I mean, for good reason, profitability has been very, very strong. Profitability growth last year's the S&P 500 is up around 47 or 48% is estimated. This year we're forecasting it to be up 7 to 17%. But when you start to see the Fed raising short-term interest rates, you usually see some sort of correction in the stock market. Pretty much happens every time as the stock market needs to reset and rethink what the future is going to be, look like. And the expectation is that the Fed will raise short-term interest rates 3 or 4 times this year for a total of 75 or 100 basis points. Longer-term rates are probably only going to move up maybe another 25 basis points or so.
Okay, so hopefully we can get this in quickly. So when I step back and look at the raw material issues, supply chain issues, worker availability, again, a paradigm shift, do you see this driving productivity improvements, moves to automation, you know, new skills? I mean, it's this necessity to become more productive. Do you see our productivity as a nation and our producers getting better?
Yeah, I mean, this is the big problem for the Fed in terms of their frustration, in terms of how the economy is doing. Not as many people are coming back to the workforce, as I said, because, you know, a lot of them have retired. Many of the younger people are not moving in. They're into the labor force as early as they did in the past. They're deciding to get more education because that's what's required for a good and profitable career. This is an enormous frustration for the Fed because it does mean slower rate of growth if you don't have as many people working. And as a result, the economy will continue to do well. I'm sorry, I didn't catch the second part of your question.
It's just about the productivity, driving productivity improvements.
That will continue, probably at a faster pace, because now all of a sudden labor is a lot more expensive. I mean, booking an airline ticket, you know, you have several options. You know, the easiest way to do it is to do it on your phone. Next is to do it on your desktop. The most inefficient way to do that is to call up the airline and book the ticket. I mean, you see that everywhere. So that will continue. You know, you're pumping your own gas. You're ordering from a kiosk at a restaurant. It's happening everywhere.
Right.
The technology is allowing that. That's the beauty of it.
Yeah. Any last thoughts on Katie before we wrap up?
Yeah, I mean, I think from an industry perspective, I think you're going to see continued adoption of digitization, automation, robotics, use of AI. I mean, I think you start thinking about, and you'll probably see this in kind of the larger tier ones and tier twos first, but, you know, the smart factories where it's connecting people, data, machines to the value chain. So I think you're going to see more adoption of those elements, those philosophies, and I think it will drive productivity.
Super. Well, this has been terrific. Thank you both so much for your time and your thoughts and comments. I really appreciate you sharing your insights. And Ivan, we can go to the next slide, please, Ivan. And so folks know, a recording of this webinar is going to be posted on the AMD Forum website under presentations and will be available to all AMD Forum members. All attendees will receive an email when the recording is available, along with contact information for attendees to gain permissions. Upcoming, on January 26th, the supply chain risk conundrum, rethinking the network and its risks. That is going to be outstanding. We've just talked a lot about the supply chain. That certainly sounds important and worth seeing. On February 16th, manufacturing the cosmos, low Earth orbit on the moon, Mars and beyond. That will be fascinating. Both of those are new national online forums. Next slide, please, Ivan. Okay. Membership in the forum. Individual membership is $350 a year, provides free attendance at all forum chapter meetings and webinars. It is free for those not located near one of the 9 operating chapters. Recordings of over 250 chapter and webinar presentations are available for download by AMD Forum members. If you were to go, if you're a member of one of the site, you'll be amazed at the things that are on there that you could review. You can join the mailing list of any chapter for free, which will also provide you the monthly AMD Forum newsletter. Opportunities to sponsor chapters or webinars are available. More info, please go to the website. Last slide, please. Thank you so much for participating. Again, great thanks to Katie and Paul for their information. great to start off the year with some perspective on where the economy is going. And I wish you all the best of health and a prosperous 2022.